Bill Chalker was born in Australia, educated at the University of New England, where he graduated with honors of science with majors in chemistry and mathematics. Now, Bill is one of Australia's leading UFO researchers and has written extensively on the subject. He is a contributing editor for the International UFO Reporter, coordinates the NSW UFO Investigation Center, and Bill was the Australian representative for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization from 1978 to 1986, and also the NSW state representative for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, from 1976 to 93. In 1996, Bill's book on the Australia UFO experience, The Oz Files, The Australian UFO Story, was published in Australia. We're going to talk with Bill tonight about a lot of these cases, including the one that I just mentioned to you a few moments ago. Bill, welcome to Coast to Coast. Good to have you with us.
Hi, George. Glad to be here.
My pleasure. How did you get interested in UFOs?
Oh, well, I guess for me it started as a kid on the north coast of New South Wales, where a lot of people were having UFO reports, etc. It seemed just about everybody in my local town of Grafton were seeing UFOs, and yet I was one of the unlucky ones at the time, I guess. But it started sort of an interest in it and a curiosity in it, and potentially because I had an interest in the science aspect of things and mysteries and in general, I took an interest in it, and that interest is clearly endured.
For those of you who have not had an opportunity to go to your websites yet, you have a striking resemblance to American actor Chuck Norris. I wonder if a lot of people have told you that.
Not too many at this stage, no. But I think a lot of people will be aware of that. No, I hadn't seen that.
You know, as you got into the UFO field, did you start as a researcher or more as a skeptic? How did that all come about?
Well, I guess as I indicated, I started my interest fairly early as a youngster, but I guess like most people get involved at that early stage, you have a lot of naive views about the subject, and I guess as time marched on, I became probably more and more skeptical, and as I became, more down the path of academia and sort of science and that kind of thing, I became somewhat skeptical, but I always kept an open viewpoint, and I guess my interest has endured in this subject because not only do I think that there's a scientific potential to the whole UFO subject, and there is obviously a valid UFO phenomenon, my interest is fairly broad in the sense that I'm interested in the historical dimensions, the sociological dimensions, the folkloric nature of it, a whole raft of different aspects. That's the kind of thing that does interest me. So I guess, in a nutshell, my interest is pretty broad.
Yeah, Bill, you've got tremendous respect for what you do all around this planet. You know, there are UFO investigators, and then there are UFO investigators, and you're one of those. You are tops in your field, and it's primarily, I think, because you do a thorough job, you know, dotting the I's, crossing the T's, and you don't leave a lot of stones unturned. Have you always been that meticulous?
Well, I've always enjoyed trying to get to the bottom of a mystery, etc., and trying to cover all aspects of it. You know, I don't pretend to be 100% thorough. I try to do the best job that I can. And obviously, when you look into a very complex story, particularly like the one that's in my latest book, because there's so much sort of hanging on it and such a bizarre story with sort of extraordinary dimensions to it, you really need to go into it as deeply as possible. And that's all part of the process.
Have you found the Australian government to be so confidential, like the U.S. government, where you're not getting much information from them, disclosure just doesn't come, and it's got a leak from people from within?
There were bits and pieces of that. I had sort of access to the files back in between 1982 and 1984, and access up to that point was difficult, and investigators like myself and others were getting really only small fragments of it and tidbits, you know, usually from people that say that they've reported things to the Royal Australian Air Force. That's the official government organisation in Australia that did investigate UFOs. And so we were getting only fragments, and from time to time you'd get a copy of a report, and often the details would be sort of edited out. And so you were only getting a sort of a a sort of a fragment of the whole story and never really the full picture of their involvement. And so, yes, I guess the picture was somewhat similar to the experience in America and in England, that kind of thing. But to suggest that perhaps they're as secretive as the American government, for example, I suspect not. I think our government has taken, I guess, the march as far as the American experience. They've used the American experience to sort of guide the way that they've looked at the whole UFO phenomenon in many ways.
And are they believers, some of them within government, that something is indeed going on?
Officially, like the American government, the answer is no. They're not believers. They're totally skeptical about it. They believe that there's nothing to the UFO phenomenon, that the small handful of, or the small percentage of unexplained sightings doesn't really represent any evidence of extraterrestrials. But certainly in my examination of the military files and coming into contact with intelligence officers and government scientists and that kind of thing, there clearly are a number of believers amongst those researchers, or amongst those participants, the government scientists and intelligence officers, that kind of thing. And but it's probably a minority position. The official position seems to be the main sort of thread that runs through all the government files, just like you seem to experience in America as well.
Of course, UFOs are all around this planet, but particularly in Australia, Bill. The data goes back how far? How many years?
I guess as far as you'd like to take it, we were as a colony of Britain initially, that was back in the late 18th century. And but there's evidence, and depending on how one interprets it, going back into the mythological records and archaeological records of the Aborigines, the original inhabitants of Australia. And so there seems to be compelling sort of information even in their stories. And as soon as white settlers arrived in Australia, stories emerged from that point on as well. Obviously not as well documented as the 20th century and 21st century stories, but nevertheless the evidence seems to suggest that the stories were there as well.
Go back a little bit about the native people, the Aborigines. Tell me a little bit about what they witnessed and how is that communicated on? How were people, maybe such as yourself, able to document that, those kinds of cases?
Well, I guess from the outset, I don't really want to dishonor the indigenous viewpoint that Aborigines have of these kinds of things as well, because many of them see them as creator figures, that kind of thing. They're important aspects of their own religion.
All right.
And I guess the take that I put on some of these is perhaps from the point of view of a Westerner's viewpoint, I guess ameliorated by the fact that we're dealing with evidence of the UFO phenomenon that we see all around us today. And so given that caveat, I kind of see in a lot of the material in the artworks, et cetera, the cave paintings, I guess the most striking of these is the Wangina paintings, and probably your listeners, most listeners would have encountered the Wangina image in the opening ceremony of the Sydney Olympic Games, where the big, huge Wangina sort of rose up out of the ground, and it was quite a striking image as far as the opening of the Olympic Games was concerned. And the most prominent feature of the Wangina is the fact that two large eyes and next to no mouth detail, etc. So it kind of resonates very powerfully with the, I guess, the alien image that we have today. But there are nevertheless other more striking kind of stories, and even in more recent decades, Aborigines themselves have had experiences with UFOs as well.
Now, their belief, though, of somewhat more of a religious belief, I guess, or faith-based belief, is primarily what? What do they believe? That we were visited by gods? Does it echo some of the things that have been written in the Bible, for example? Are there similarities there?
We as Westerners can read that into it, but from the Aboriginal point of view, it seems to be more of a kind of a continuous presence, in the sense that they have a concept that we sort of describe as, or refer to as, the dream time, a sort of a constant presence of this kind of reality all around them. And they see that reality right through the landscape, and it manifests both in the landscape, but also in just about everything they see. And for example, the Wangina figures were closely related, it seems, to clouds and that kind of thing, and water and droughts and that kind of thing. And so there was a kind of an intimate interrelationship between this. But when, I guess, Western eyes start to look at these kinds of situations, you know, the idea that the Wanjina came out of the clouds, etc., has a lot of resonances with modern-day imagery of cloud-like UFOs and all that kind of thing. So it's one has to be fairly cautious about making these kinds of connections, and I've tried to constantly sort of reaffirm that, I guess, caution that one needs to have on these ancient accounts.
But is it your opinion, though, that the native people of Australia do or do not believe in extraterrestrial visitations?
I think the belief system seems to be probably much akin to the Western population in Australia, in the sense that a large number of people, white people, etc., in Australia, believe in the reality of UFOs. And similarly, I think it's probably much the same in Aboriginal populations as well. But one of the most striking things for me, in terms of the indigenous culture, the actual more primitive culture, they have this sort of strong ritual of shamans that you'd be probably familiar with in West, places like America and South America and Africa and that kind of thing. And those kind of initiation ceremonies seem to have very kind of explicit correlations with UFO abduction accounts. They're often referred to here as men of high degree, because I guess Hollywood sort of portrays them like witch doctors, but sort of crazy witch doctors. But in reality, they were probably the most prominent and most important people of their tribe. And that's why they were regarded as men of high degree, because they had such remarkable abilities. But those men, those shamans or men of high degree, got those abilities, they said, by direct encounters with the sky gods. And usually this was in kind of like an abduction experience, where they were taken into a strange environment, up into the sky world, and some of these sky beings were referred to as like Bayami or Bijabal. There were all sorts of names given to them, but these belief systems were right across Australia, and they seemed to always involve a kind of an abduction of the initiate, taken up into the sky world. They've even got situations where strange artifacts are put inside their bodies. In the case of Aboriginals, their crystals, and abductees, their implants. There's all sorts of different correlations there.
How many cases do you believe you've researched in your career so far?
I've lost count. It's certainly in the hundreds and hundreds of accounts, et cetera, of all sorts of different types of cases.
I ask you that, Bill, because some researchers believe that these are extraterrestrial. Others believe that they may be coming from other dimensions, perhaps some kind of parallel universe. Where do you stand on that?
I tend to try and stay open-minded, because whenever one sort of gets fixated on a particular explanation, along comes a case that sort of blows that explanation away, sort of thing. So given the totality of the kind of cases that I've dealt with, and my awareness of the worldwide sort of UFO experience, I kind of think that perhaps a nuts and bolts extraterrestrial explanation is probably somewhat simplistic, and that maybe the reality involved is a lot far stranger than we can possibly kind of imagine. And that certainly resonates with what people are individually experiencing as well. And I guess people like Michio Kaku, quantum physicist, he's made some positive statements about the UFO subject in recent times, suggesting that it deserves serious attention, and that's something I definitely agree with. But he also argues that, well, maybe it might represent some sort of interaction with a very, very advanced kind of culture. And even the arch UFO skeptic Arthur C. Clarke said that any sufficiently advanced civilization or technology would appear like magic to us, you know. And that seems to, in many ways, resonate very nicely with what the UFO phenomenon seems to be doing. It seems to be a kind of a very striking and advanced kind of intrusion or interaction with our society.
Do you have any particular expertise in the UFO field? I mean, some people love these modern cases. Other people like to go way back to the days of antiquity.
Well, I've had kind of specializations in a number of those areas that you refer to. I guess over a number of decades, I've been recognised as a specialist in physical evidence type cases, okay. And particularly UFO landing cases. And I guess the fellow in the States that's most well known in that area is Ted Phillips, who did a lot of enduring work with UFO landing cases and examining the physical traces left behind. That's something that I've shared that interest with him on that. And to me, that was kind of like you could take that physical evidence into a laboratory and examine the chemical differences, the physical differences, that kind of thing. And I guess that interest is not too far from the current interest that I have, which is kind of shifted not into just the inorganic area, but into the biological area, where we're examining biological evidence involved with UFO abduction cases. And of course, that's where my new book, Hair of the Alien, comes in, that it focuses on that kind of approach.
And we'll get into this in a second. This is a fascinating theory here. It's one of those that you can't put down once you start, Bill. Have you ever witnessed yourself firsthand some of the landing sites of some of these sightings?
Well, in terms of seeing a UFO land or just going out to physically investigate
them? No, just the physical investigating, and then you see remains of the site.
Yeah, in Australia, I've investigated hundreds of those sorts of UFO landing cases. And
what do they look like? Are they all burned out or tripod?
Well, they certainly don't approximate the kind of complexity that one sees in English crop circles, but these are generally fairly straightforward, simple kinds of circles, and the variation of them tends to be a variant based on the topography or the nature of the land on which it occurs. One of the most famous cases that we had was back in 1966 with a farmer, George Pedley, who in broad daylight at 9 o'clock in the morning got to within 30 feet of a 30-foot wide object rising up out of a tidal lagoon area, and it had sort of swordgrass reeds in that lagoon, and he saw the object rise up and then take off. So he had a very clear, unobstructed view of it, and it was clearly a structured object. But when he looked at where it had come from, he saw just a clear body of water, and then when he returned later, he found that the reeds there had actually risen to the surface again and matted into a really intensely matted bed of about 30 feet wide of the reeds that had been ripped up from the ground at the bottom. And so it was a kind of a very striking physical picture of the reality of the event that clearly were left behind with a strong physical trace. And that case got a lot of publicity both here in Australia and worldwide. And in fact, according to Doug and Dave, the two old chaps that were implicated in some of the early hoaxing of the English crop circles, mm-hmm. it was that particular case that inspired them to carry out their hoaxing in England. But there was never any doubt that George Pedley saw a real event and that the Tully case itself was authentic.
Bill, stay with us. When we come back, we'll talk about some cases that you have regarded as very significant in the field of ufology. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Bill Chucker, who is live in Australia. Bill, what are some of the significant historical cases that you've either investigated or even checked up on?
Well, there's quite a few to pick from, but I'll just sort of focus on some of the more interesting ones from me personally.
Sure.
One of the most famous cases that I guess came out of the Australian region was the Father Gill case that occurred at a missionary area called Bowenai in Papua New Guinea, which back in 1959 was still a territory of Australia. Now it's an independent country. And Father Gill was running a Anglican mission there at that time, and there was a whole wave of UFO sightings that seemed to break out all over the Papua New Guinea area. This is the big island nation directly to the north of Australia, and quite a lot of people were reporting sightings, missionaries, even a lot of the Westerners, the Australians and that kind of thing, and the territorial people, and even some of the missionary people and missionary staff were seeing things. But Father William Gill, he was rather sceptical of what was being reported, and that scepticism got swept aside over two consecutive nights during late June 1959 when he observed with quite a large number of the natives there in the area, a large structured object that hovered nearby. And what made the case fairly extraordinary was that they witnessed the movement of animate beings backwards and forwards on top of the object. And on the second night, this thing, this display seemed to repeat itself. The object seemed to have returned. And on the second night, they were able to interact with it. They were shining torches at it, trying to get it to come closer. And it appeared to come closer, but it then seemed to remain at a set distance. And then the figures seemed to wave back, returning the waves of the people on the ground, the witnesses on the ground, and this caused quite a commotion. And researchers worldwide regard that case as being very impressive, probably mainly from the point of view that Father Gill had pretty impressive credentials. You know, he was a credible witness, and the native missionary people and the native villagers, etc., who were also witnesses, confirmed his description of it and that kind of thing. So it was a very striking kind of case, a very well-witnessed, I guess one would call it, entity case or close encounter of the third kind, although it was still a little bit distant, but large enough to be a clearly structured object with animate beings.
I remember reading that case, Bill, when I was a boy. It was in one of the NICAP journals at the time, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, which was way back. And I'm glad you brought this up. Did anybody ever ask the father or anybody if they thought maybe this might have been a modern dirigible that nobody knew about in those days? I mean, did they exist? I guess they did, didn't they?
Well, one of the early thoughts that Father Gill himself had of it was that it was some sort of secret American device, etc., but it became very clear that this was no secret device by Americans or any sort of power at that time, because it just seemed to be so much beyond what we were capable of at that time. And and you have to bear in mind that this was occurring against a backdrop of a lot of sightings occurring right across Papua New Guinea. There were a lot of efforts to try and explain what he saw. Even the art skeptic Professor Donald Menzel in America tried to write it off as Father Gill wearing incorrectly prescribed glasses and having acute myopia and observing the planet Venus and that kind of stuff, and yet he didn't seem to bother to take on board the fact that there were a lot of native witnesses as well. And I've met Father Gill on quite a few occasions, and one thing he did point out was that he was wearing correctly prescribed glasses at the time, a detail that Professor Menzel neglected to ask. And a lot of people argued that the whole case was made up and that Father Gill never existed in reality, but I can certainly attest to the reality of it, because he is quite a credible and reliable witness, and I've met him on a number of occasions and interviewed him at length and dissected the case, gone over the official files, gone through it in a lot of detail, and I'm still satisfied that here we have a very credible witness seeing an unexplained flying object, and I guess that sort of says it all, that he observed something that was definitely unexplainable.
That is a great case. What else do you have in your UFO files there?
I guess one of the other early cases from the 50s was a case that involved Australian Navy pilot. He was flying a Sea Fury aircraft on a night reconnaissance run, and one has to bear in mind that the Sea Fury of its day back in 1954 was probably one of the fastest aircraft travelling around Australian skies, and he was on a routine night cross-country run, and he was over a town called Goulburn in New South Wales, and he was scheduled to take a communication from his base station, which is Nayara Naval Air Station, to the south, and he was expecting that kind of communication to come up any time soon. But what really concerned him was that just prior to that radio contact, two objects appeared and took up station either side of the wingtips of his aircraft, and they were there for a number of minutes, and at one point came so close that he was starting to get very, very concerned that he was going to have a collision with these objects. And he was kind of thinking about reporting it himself over the radio, but he kind of saw his career as a naval pilot starting to disappear before his very eyes.
It would dwindle away, indeed.
That's right. And so, but luckily for him, the base contacted him first and asked, well, you know, who have you got up there with you? You seem to have company because we're tracking it here on the radar back at the base. So he was quite pleased to have that confirmation because he didn't want to report it himself. And so Nowra Naval Air Station tracked the pilot, the aircraft, and the two objects for a while, and then they seemed to take off at high speed. And according to the pilot, Seamus O'Farrell, who I've also spoken to directly to get his story, he said that the objects left him, making him and his aircraft look as though they were sitting still. And yet this was an aircraft which was one of the fastest aircraft in the skies over Australia at that time. And that case had an acute fascination for military people right throughout the decades that followed. And in fact, in 1973, when Dr. Alan Hynek, the
one of the best at the time, he used to head up the Project Blue Book for a long time for the Air Force.
Yeah, and he was the consultant for the Air Force, of course, over there. But he visited Australia in 1973 mainly to focus on some of the high strangeness cases that he had come across in his career. And one of the ones that he wanted to look at was this case of Seamus O'Farrell and the Sea Fury case, the radar visual sighting in 1954. And Seamus was not too keen to be asked to get involved with Hynek at the time, but he was actually officially told by the Secretary of Defence, who was a very powerful defence person in the hierarchy of the Australian government. He was told in no uncertain terms that you will talk to Hynek. And then Seamus just tried the defence of amnesia or having forgotten about it, and he was told the official files will be on your doorstep within an hour or two. And within that time, the assistant to the Secretary of Defence turned up with the two official files, but these weren't naval intelligence files or RAAF files. They were actually the JIB files, which is the Joint Intelligence Bureau files, and there was one file entirely devoted to him as a person as to how credible a witness he was, and it concluded that he was a highly credible witness. And the other file was the detail on the case, which included tracings of the radar correlations and all that kind of thing, and interviews with the radar operator and that kind of thing. So it was a very, very impressive case, but that was the first time that he had seen the secret official file in his own experience decades later.
The cases of Roswell, New Mexico, in this country, Bill, one of the most staggering UFO cases, I think, ever. The technology that might have been involved, the reverse engineering, the reports of the aliens, the witnesses, many of whom have died off now. Have you ever had a crashed UFO case in Australia like Roswell?
Well, in actual fact, we've had quite a few anecdotal type stories that seem to approximate the story in Roswell, but none of them, to my mind, were ever all that compelling, although at this point in time, over the last couple of years, I've been investigating a particularly interesting kind of variation on the Roswell story, I guess. It came to me from Aboriginal witnesses in the outback, and I'm going to be fairly circumspect about the locality because, for obvious reasons,
sure, I understand.
If everybody finds out where it is, it'll be kind of like a carnival atmosphere, the kind of thing that seems to happen in Roswell today, unfortunately. But so for that reason, I won't identify it. But there was the story seems to revolve around an event that occurred back on the day of the moon landing in July 1969, and there was a remote mission station that where there was a couple of missionary staff who were also Aboriginal but were members of the religious community at that time. But also there were about 200 children and mainly Aboriginal women present at the mission. And they were all basically being asked to be involved in a special service to honour the astronauts landing on the moon and to pray for them and all that kind of thing. And that it was during that event where most of the children were outside kind of playing, and the actual mission people had come out. And at that point, they observed an object some distance away rise up and it seemed to hover for some time. And then it seemed to move to one side, and then it seemed to go straight down behind a small hill. And then from that position, there was like a huge mushroom cloud that rose up. And at that point, the The two religious people there that were present sort of immediately fell to the ground, screaming out to everybody, you know, that it's the end of the world. They took on a very kind of religious kind of interpretation of the event, but it wasn't the end of the world, of course. And amongst those children witnesses, there was one individual that this story remained indelibly imprinted on his mind, and he kept becoming obsessed with it, so much so that, you know, he kept it within the Aboriginal community, and this story only leaked out when he told it to me, and so it really didn't see the light of day amongst the white community in the area. But he became, even in recent times, so involved with trying to confirm the experience that even his own local Aboriginal friends would call him Roswell as a nickname, because they became aware of the Roswell story from America. And but more recently, a couple of years ago, there were a number of young Aboriginal men involved in a kangaroo hunting party, they were out hunting kangaroos, and they came across a strange debris field, and this seemed to consist of artifacts embedded into the ground, a huge sort of dish-shaped thing, like they thought was like a sort of a very bulky kind of wing thing, and all sorts of unusual artifacts. And they really didn't take it on board. They thought, well, maybe it was a crashed plane or something like that, or something of that nature, but kept going. They did notice that the dogs that they had with them avoided that area. They wouldn't go near it. And so it seemed odd to them. They went back, they claimed, to check it out a little bit later, but when they tried to go to the area, they said that there was UFO activity in that area. Now, I'm not sure what to make of those elements, but it was a fairly strange story. But this chap, who was a child witness back in 69, overheard this story, and when he asked them where they had encountered this, they were a bit uncertain about the exact location, but they were able to correlate the rough direction of it, and it appears that the line of sight that occurred back in 1969 and where this locality was in more recent years seemed to intersect. So we seem to have at least compelling anecdotal evidence that there's something there. Now, I've been back with some of those young people and also the original witness in 1969, and we've done a number of field investigations on foot covering a lot of territory. And this is fairly difficult terrain. And in fact, I came to the conclusion that you literally have to walk over it to be able to find the area. But I've done a plane flight over it as well, hanging out of a light aircraft with a video camera, trying to get documentation of it. And there were a couple of things that we got on film that look somewhat interesting, but we're still sort of left with the situation that we're trying to verify this mainly on foot because of the nature of the terrain, and we don't want to draw too much attention to it by flying in helicopters and all that kind of stuff to do the aerial survey, because that just raises the whole profile of the area. So we're trying to do it without as much interference and difficulties as possible, but it'll we're not too far off from the situation where we're probably going to have to resort to a helicopter survey because of the difficulty of the ground survey work.
Is it possible that if there was a crashed saucer there, that other saucers might have taken away some of the artifacts, cleaned it up a little bit?
Well, this is the implication of the young sort of men who had the encounter with what they saw as a debris field, with their claims that there had been some sort of UFO encounter, but it's hard to tell. But given the nature and the credibility of the witnesses and the story, etc., I'm still of the opinion that it's still definitely worthwhile trying to verify the nature of the story and whether or not there is any kind of confirmable debris field. And we hope it's still there, so we hope to come across it.
Oh, if you could only find some artifacts, Bill. Wouldn't that be something?
Well, unfortunately, Roswell has had that problem as well for decades now.
Absolutely.
Lots of interesting stories, but no actual confirmable artifacts.
Now, you know, we've heard reports of metal that almost liquefies, and, you know, you can touch it, and then it pops back to its original state. And then there was a metal bar that had some strange inscriptions on it, much like Egyptian hieroglyphs. But that's it. Nobody's really had that in their possession where we could look at it. And that's the unfortunate part about this. You don't have a lot of hard evidence, do you?
Right. Well, in this particular case, I've had the opportunity to go over a lot of the local kind of data and information, etc., and I've been able to rule out most kind of straightforward explanations, such as plane crashes and that kind of thing. And so I don't have an explanation for either what the gentleman saw back in 1969 with the other 200 Aborigines, nor do I have a direct explanation for what the young men encountered as a debris field in more recent years. But we're hoping that if we keep at it, we'll find it, and I'll be going at it a fourth time very shortly to continue that ground survey work.
Bill, tell me a little bit about the book, Here of the Alien, which we'll talk about next hour, but is it available at bookstores now? How do people obtain it?
Yeah, my understanding is it is generally available in bookstores in the United States, but for those that might have difficulty getting hold of it, it's procurable through outlets like Amazon.com, that kind of thing.
Pocket Books published it, so it's probably all over the place. And then your website, do you have a favorite one? We've got a couple listed for you here.
Well, right now, at the moment, probably in terms of commentary and discussion and up-to-date research, I've got my own sort of weblog or blog site in the vernacular, and that's at the Ozfiles, ozfiles.blogspot.com. And for those that link into that, I gather you've got the link on your website.
Absolutely.
There. They can sort of keep up to date as to, I guess, background and debate and discussion on the book, and also on the research that I'm doing in a lot of different areas.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk about many more of these cases. Also, what are the possibilities of Australian pilots seeing UFOs? I want to get your take on that, Bill, when we come back. You've also had a tremendous interest in UFOs in China. We'll chat about that. And then the book, The Investigation, Here of the Alien, maybe some DNA here. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. Bill, we have been getting reports for years now about huge triangular-shaped objects in the United States. Do you get that in Australia as well?
We do get them, but probably not as frequently as you seem to get them in the U.S.
Are they close to military bases by any chance? Because ours seem to be.
We've had quite a few in the in Western Australia and a number of other locations, but in terms of proximity to the bases, that's not a correlation that we've had explicitly here.
What about the pilots from Australia? Have they seen anything strange, any reports that they send in?
Well, the pilot experience I mentioned earlier, for example, Seamus O'Farrell, he's one of the more famous pilot sightings from here in Australia because he had the benefit of radar correlation. But we've certainly had quite an impressive number of interesting cases from pilots, and obviously they're of interest to us because we're dealing with sort of highly credible and trained sort of witnesses, and in a kind of a controlled platform flying through the sky. And obviously when they see something like a UFO, you've got an excellent point of reference, and occasionally you often get radar correlations as well.
Have you ever had a case that you looked into of a pilot named Valentich at all?
Well, that obviously is one of the more extraordinary cases because it represents not only a pilot's encounter with a UFO over Bass Strait back in 1978, but also, unfortunately, he totally disappeared from that experience as well. He was flying over Bass Strait on the way over to King Island, an island in the middle of Bass Strait, before you get to the major southern state of Tasmania, and he reported over a period of a number of minutes, a conversation that was recorded between himself and radio control at Moorabbin, an encounter with a strange object that came into close proximity with his aircraft. But unfortunately, when the conversation ended after about 6 minutes, that was the end of it, and a massive search was instigated trying to locate both him and the aircraft, but to this day, there's never been any kind of confirmation, and the government assumes that he went down into the sea and was never relocated, but really the mystery remains, and it's a fairly powerful example of this kind of UFO encounter.
Was there ever any proof of panic in his voice? People that were talking to him moments before he vanished?
Well, I've heard the tape, and to me, obviously, there was some evidence of anxiety, but he was a reasonably well-trained individual. He was still trying to work to get his sort of full grading and that kind of thing, but he obviously was concerned about what he was observing, but and towards the end of the conversation, particularly as the objects seemed to be orbiting above the aircraft and in close proximity there, it does seem that he seemed to be becoming more and more concerned about it. So, to me, it seems to be a pretty impressive kind of case, and also there were multiple sightings of objects reported by individuals both on the Victorian mainland, which is the southern state just before you go out over Bass Strait, and also on King Island where he was heading to, and also in northern Tasmania, which is the southern part of adjacent to Bass Strait, the large ocean area between those two states.
That's an incredible story, Bill. You can imagine being in his shoes at that time, seeing this kind of object, and then getting close enough, and then gone. He's gone.
Yeah. Well, I can vividly, still to this day, vividly remember what I was doing at that time. And I first heard the report of the disappearance of an aircraft over Bass Strait back in October 78. I was actually heading up to an area called St. George in southern Queensland, which was well known as a major UFO hotspot. And as the story unraveled, within a very short period of time, a matter of 24 hours, the story turned from a disappearance of an aircraft and pilot to a major UFO mystery, because the ground-to-air conversation leaked out, and it was literally front pages story right around the world and caused quite a sensation. But sadly, I guess the reality of it is that Frederick Valentich disappeared and hasn't been found since.
Bill, if he was taken, why? Why do you think they just decided to take him, the craft? They've never brought him back, obviously. What are they doing with him?
I wouldn't like to really speculate that that's exactly what happened. You know, the implication is there, but I don't have any credible evidence to verify that he was indeed taken by a UFO in a classic kind of abduction. When I was involved with the Aerial Phenomena Organization, which was really an excellent international organization based in America and run by Jim and Coral Lorenzen,
yes.
They actually put me on to or asked me to investigate a connection of an American contactee or abductee who claimed that he had been told by the beings abducting him that Frederick Valentich had indeed been taken, and that that he was with them. You know, it was a pretty bizarre story, and so I approached Frederick's father, Guido, and he kindly provided a series of test questions that I could put to the abductee that APRO were dealing with.
That only the father would probably know.
That's right. You know, I asked them to do a double-blind experiment. I told Guido not to tell me the answers either, so that I didn't know, and certainly Jim and Carl Lorenzen didn't know.
Right.
But the reason for doing that was that while there were obviously concerns about whether this was a valid experience or not, Guido still felt that it was important to try and follow through on this to see if there was any truth to it. And it was a bit of a downer in terms of the ending, because the abductee concerned became increasingly concerned that he himself was going to possibly have the same fate that Frederick Valentich had, that he may not return from a subsequent abduction experience, and thus he ultimately backed out of it and didn't want to try and put himself in a situation where he claimed he was being abducted. So we never really got the chance to try this test of the double-blind questions.
Oh, that would have been something, too, if you could have done that, had he answered them correctly, too. But
yes.
For not. You've done some homework into China. Are they a little more open than the United States, therefore, or Australia?
It seems, in terms of the current manifestation of Chinese ufology, that yes, they seem to be much more open about it, and there seems to be a much more kind of high-profile embrace with the subject. And possibly that's because of China's history, being a communist country, etc., and a lot of suppression of, I guess, public thought and, I guess, interactions with the kind of subjects and freedom of thought that we enjoy here in Western countries. That didn't really exist until in more recent years, and that's still developing. But Chinese ufology really didn't take off until the late 70s, early 80s, and ever since that point, it's really embraced it. But because of the restrictions in China, the UFO groups really seem to be the domain of mainly scientists and engineering types, and in fact, that seemed to be the criteria of membership of the UFO groups. And because of that, there's a very heavy weighting of scientific types and fairly well-qualified individuals that seem to run these groups, and as a consequence, there seems to be a significant embrace with the UFO phenomenon and a lot of documentation of some interesting and quite fascinating cases. So it seems to be taken much more seriously over there.
So we can always assume that this is a worldwide phenomenon. It's happening everywhere, and every nook and cranny in the planet has probably been going on since the beginning of time on this planet. If we had and I know it's tough to speculate, but I'm sure you've tried to think about where they might be coming from, Bill, what their mission might be, the types of alien civilizations that could be out there. We've all heard the different kinds. Have you tried to put them all together? Have you tried to come up with a theory yourself on just what do you think is going on?
I've tried many, many times, et cetera. And as I've said, usually a case comes along and bowls over that hypothesis, and you're back to square one trying to speculate as to what this is all really about. And I guess at the moment, for example, with the DNA evidence that we've done with this Hair of the Alien book and the case there, the DNA has given us sort of kind of clues that might be legitimate kind of clues that might give us some perspective as to what might really be going on with abduction-type cases. And instead of it's given us kind of perspectives that take us back into our historical past as well, and with clear sort of, or seemingly clear interactions with stories in, for example, Celtic traditions of these advanced beings called the Tuatha Dé Nann in Ireland, that kind of thing. This seems to be kind of crazy at first inspection, but when you start to get into these kind of mythic traditions that seem to focus around Ireland and that kind of thing, and describe these tall beings with often blonde and orange hair and that kind of thing, that resonate very strongly with stories that we have today of the Nordic types of alien beings. It may be more than just a strange speculation. There could be some solid correlations here, because we were led to this connection via the DNA evidence rather than the other way around.
The case studies, of course, that you've looked at, you mentioned J. Allen Hynek. I remember being in Detroit when he went on television and said that some episodes in Michigan were swamp gas. And I just saw the reporters just shaking their heads at what he was saying. But what really started to open up my eyes about this field was when he changed his mind. And he went from being what I thought was an obvious skeptic to someone who was a true believer that there was something very unusual going on in this universe.
Yes, I agree there, because there's a lot of revisionist history going on that sort of kind of seems to be trying to portray Hynek as a bit of an arch debunker and skeptic. And he was, I guess, a scientific skeptic, but as you have highlighted there, he was shifted by the weight of evidence, the sheer weight of evidence being exposed for decades with his involvement with the US Air Force. And he slowly, as a cautious scientist, became aware of the obvious reality here, that we're dealing with something quite real. And I had the pleasure of staying with him back in 1984 at his Chicago home, and sadly passed away a few years later. But I had the opportunity to go through a lot of his files and talk to him and interview him and that kind of thing. And even then, he was still quite focused on the legitimacy of the UFO subject as a credible area of scientific research, and right to his last days, he was constantly advocating the serious scientific attention of the subject.
I've never seen a UFO. How about you?
Well, I've certainly seen some unusual things. I've not had an abduction experience, that kind of thing, but one of the most I guess, direct ones that I had was actually on the campus of the University of New England, coming home from a late evening chemistry practical class, and it was just on twilight, and the only thing that was really on my mind was to get to the cafeteria so I could have dinner before it closed. And as I was crossing the quadrangle, there were two other students crossing the area and looking up and pointing, and I looked across to what they were looking at and observed what appeared to be a dish-shaped metallic object that gave the impression to me that it was only about 200 feet up. It appeared to travel over very, very slowly, and I thought, well, you know, what the hell could this be? It was very clear and quite explicit in its shape, and I didn't think it was it certainly didn't appear to be an aircraft, and it didn't seem to be a balloon, and yet I knew that if I rushed through the college buildings on the other side where its trajectory was taking it, there'd be a clear, uninterrupted view for miles. And so I'd be able to absolutely ascertain what this object was. And so I rushed through within seconds. And as I got through to the other side, unfortunately, the object was no longer in view. So it clearly wasn't an aircraft. It clearly wasn't a balloon. And to this day, I have no idea what it was.
Did you ever think about these coming from within the planet, that they've been here for a long time?
Well, there's certainly lots of compelling sort of evidence that suggests that this phenomenon has been around and with us for a long, long time, but I tend to feel that much of it seems to be nudging us to a sort of an off-worldly kind of explanation. But again, you're probably sensing from me a degree of caution here because of the complexity of the UFO phenomenon, that there are just so many complex attributes to the whole UFO subject that really prevents us from easy categorization as to what's going on.
Why do they seem to go in flaps, Bill? I mean, we get cases where you get many UFO stories and reports, they go away. And then in another region, you get a whole bunch of them, then they go away. How come does it appear to show up in different stages?
Well, to me, there are two different kinds of flaps. There's a kind of a nationwide or very large-scale kind of flap, which quite often sometimes can be sustained by media attention and all that kind of thing. And so there's a kind of degree of artificiality to it. But the flaps that really impressed me the most are the ones that are extremely localized and often hidden from public view or media view and localized into very isolated areas. And only once in my career have I ever been involved in one which was occurring and that I was able to get there while the UFO flap was actually happening, and that allowed me and other people that were with me from the University of New England to able to observe the unfolding UFO phenomenon as well. It was a really quite a striking and exciting time for us. But what we experienced there was a phenomenon that seemed to be so evasive, it went beyond mere chance. Like, we would set up cameras on tripods, on heavy-duty tripods, to record the phenomenon that had been occurring in one direction night after night. We set up the cameras, and these were really heavy-duty things that were very difficult to rearrange, and as soon as we're waiting for them, where they'd been appearing, they would appear behind us. And that, it was just extraordinarily frustrating. But to us, it was evident that something very strange was going on. And there was a lot of unusual aspects to it that almost got into the kind of the paranormal aspect of it. But I guess paranormal could be maybe a technology that we don't understand. We call it paranormal, but maybe it's an ability that, or a way of interacting with things that we don't fully understand.
Tell me about why you concentrate also on the solid light cases, UFO cases.
Well, to me, one of the enduring aspects of the UFO phenomenon is that obviously at night there's obviously light associated with it, but the UFOs themselves seem to be able to control light in a way that is up till more recently seems to be, well, it's certainly still totally beyond us, but in recent times there's been experiments done with almost slowing light down and making it stop almost, and these are really cutting-edge sort of experimentations going on in the world of physics today, but UFOs seem to be doing this kind of thing for decades, literally, and they seem to be able to manipulate light and turn it into things like a solid tube, and some of these tubes can bend. And one striking case that I describe in my book here, The Alien, is one of where this solid tube of light comes out of the object at an oblique angle, It appears to have all the connotations of a solid tube of light, and then it seems to detach itself from the object, go down obliquely, and it collides with the top of an amenities block at a beach area, at a place called Kiama in southern New South Wales. When the tube collided with the top of the amenities block, it seemed to change its physical nature from a solid into a liquid, and it seemed to flow down over the amenities block like honey. This also happened to a bunch of people, apparently, according to the reporting witness, a bunch of people on the beach. One of these tubes went down and seemed to descend upon them, and they were seen to be trying to push it off them, and then the fire that they had on the beach went out, and unfortunately the witness was he was really agitated that something must have happened to them, but he was never able to find out who these people were, and it was a very striking encounter. But these solid light cases, to me, are very impressive because they seem to represent a control over a fundamental phenomenon, light, that's so important to us, and yet they seem to be able to control it in ways that we just can't handle at the moment.
Story that we talked about when we introduced you, Bill, we will talk about when we come back, the incredible story of 28-year-old then, Peter Corey, who was awoken by what appeared to be two females kneeling on his bed. Now, one might think, hey, how about that? No, this was not an angelic experience. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, Bill Chalker, our guest. Bill, 1992, tell me about the incredible story of then 28-year-old Peter Corey.
Well, Peter was actually recovering from a head injury he received in a job situation and job assault, and unfortunately had a bit of a set to with some builders in the building trade, and that led to him having a head injury. That led him to be off work for quite some considerable time, and he was on some limited medication, which I guess people speculate, well, either the head injury or the medication might account for this, but that just doesn't take on board the fact that we had physical evidence that was recovered from this that really prevents that as an appropriate explanation. But ultimately, he had just dropped his wife off early in the morning at about 7:30 to the railway station so she could go to work. He comes back to his house, locks the door, and so we have a secure environment, which he lies back down on his bed again. He believed that he sort of dropped off to sleep, but then he seemed to be woken up by the impression that something light had somehow jumped onto the bed or impacted with the bed very lightly. At that point, he kind of woke up, he had a sort of a very unusual disorientation effect occurring, as if he could see through himself, almost like it was out of the body kind of thing. But
yeah,
that lasted for only a very short duration of a few seconds, and then he was like it was a reality, something quite real, and that it became intentionally real when he could see that there were two female beings here, or two female people here, on the bed, both naked, one that appeared to be a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, I guess for want of a better description, a Scandinavian-looking woman, a naughty-type woman, and the other one appeared to be a black-haired, Asian-looking woman, and they were on the edge of the bed, and the blonde woman grabbed hold of Peter and drew him to her breast three times. And Peter, unfortunately, has been claustrophobic at the best of times, and he was trying to recover from the shock of this because obviously it's, one could sort of look at this as a kind of a sexual fantasy, but it just wasn't a pleasant experience because he was really recovering from an illness.
Poor Peter gets claustrophobic in a case where a lot of people would go, okay.
Yeah. Well, Peter has obviously gone through a situation where he's tried to reanalyze his behavior here, and he has trouble trying to sort of cope with what he actually did here, and probably felt, if it happened again, maybe things would occur differently, but he could only describe it in the way that it occurred to him at the time. And as I said, this blonde woman was sort of pulling him to her breast, and to try and resist that And I should mention here that Peter is no weakling. He works in the building trade, a very strong man, yeah. And yet this woman appeared to be extremely strong, even stronger than him. That's something that he was a bit reluctant to admit to. But so he tried to resist this, but she kept doing this sort of strange behaviour, and then ultimately he ended up biting her on the breast. And the reaction that occurred then was that she drew away abruptly, but didn't seem to register any pain, which under normal human circumstances, that would be excruciatingly painful for any woman to be bitten in that area. And he then got the kind of mental impression conveyed from that blonde woman to the Asian-looking woman that this is not right, this is not the way that it's supposed to happen. And he immediately, Peter immediately started to have a coughing fit, as if he'd ingested something from biting the woman. And he started to cough very badly, and then at that point he sort of looked down, and then he looked up again, and then the two women were no longer there. And he then went to the bathroom, got a glass of water to try and sort of reduce this coughing sensation that he's experiencing. Yeah. And it was at that point that he felt a powerful urge to urinate, and it was at that point that he observed the presence of this hair sample wrapped around his private part, and that's the bizarre nature of the story.
What a bizarre story.
It is. Well,
I mean, first of all, let me ask you a few questions. How do we know old Peter wasn't having some kind of an affair and needed some bizarre excuse to keep his wife at bay?
Well, you know, that's obviously a speculation, and obviously it was an issue that I have to say probably Peter would characterize it in this way, that I kind of interrogated him on this aspect as well, and obviously interviewed his wife, interviewed his friends and family and all that kind of stuff, interviewed practically everybody who knew Peter, liked Peter, hated Peter, the whole broad cross-section. And so I've done a fairly detailed examination of the bona fides of this. But the ultimate reality of it was that if Peter had been having some sort of terrestrial affair, and this was a bizarre cover story or related to it, then it just doesn't pan out, because with the hair sample that was recovered, we subjected that to DNA, and I indicated to Peter that this represented a risk, because we were interested in trying to challenge the validity of his story subjecting it to a forensic examination. And I warned him that if we did this and it came up as a completely prosaic, ordinary hair sample, which is, I have to be honest, that's what I expected it to be.
And you would have told him, you would have told his wife too, yeah. I assume, right?
And that's right. And he would have had a lot of explaining to do. But it was absolutely certain about the reality of this. And because he had had an earlier abduction experience back in 1988, that was more like the traditional kind of abduction experience with these grey beings and that kind of stuff. He put it immediately into that context of an alien abduction context, because of while they appear to be human, that the blonde, for example, had a very large kind of pointed angular face. Her eyes were about 2 to 3 times the size of ordinary human eyes. And so to him, while she had an alien, a human-like appearance, she did seem to have this kind of rather strange alien-like appearance.
Well, did this appearance, was it so distinct that she looked strange, or if he would, say, see her walking on the street in clothes, would he simply say, "Oh, it's an interesting-looking woman"? How would he have reacted?
Well, his attitude was that she would stand out, particularly with the striking appearance of her face and the extraordinarily large eyes. That would have been a dead giveaway as far as if he had the situation encountering her on the street, for example.
That she wasn't human.
She clearly seemed very strange.
Okay, and how about the Asian-looking one?
Well, the Asian woman looked a little bit more traditionally human-like, but she also had somewhat angular features, but she also appeared to have virtually totally black eyes. And so she certainly had odd features about her, but she seemed less, I guess, alien than the blonde woman did. But she seemed to be just having a passive role in this whole encounter.
Oh,
but with Peter, it was really, what it came down to was really the hair sample and having the presence of mind to preserve that sample. And we had a kind of a chain of evidence situation set up so that we could at least authenticate the connection of the sample to Peter. And then we did the DNA work, and it was the DNA results that really provided compelling proof that we had a pretty bizarre situation on here, because it wasn't just a straightforward DNA sequence that we got out of the actual sample. It was far stranger than that.
Was it stranger than anything it could be compared to any kind of human hair? Totally different?
We did this work in two phases. We focused on the hair shark to begin with, and we did what's called a mitochondrial DNA sequence on it. Being a blonde, almost transparent, optically transparent kind of hair sample, and looking at the blonde, blue-eyed lady, we expected, if it was going to be anything, that it would be perhaps Caucasian or Scandinavian type DNA, just to put her in a particular human category, I guess. But what we got from this blonde hair sample was a very rare Asian mongoloid DNA, which really should have been, if it was going to be apparent to anybody, would have been present in black-haired people rather than blonde hair. And so straight away we had a very strange anomaly, and yet that Asian mongoloid DNA sequence was pretty rare, quite rare, and we did a search on the huge sort of DNA database to try and correlate this, and it was only present in a few candidates, et cetera, and even then you would expect those people to be dark-haired, as you expect most Asian people to be.
Now, who's to say that these candidates that are on this planet already might not be alien?
Well, that's a speculation that's passed our minds, but we obviously aren't in a position to prove that. But I have had information indicating that other people have encountered similar kind of beings to what Peter's described, and obviously we're trying to investigate those cases as thoroughly as we can. But that result was strange enough in itself, but we also focused on the root of the hair as well. We were able to confirm that Asian mongoloid DNA, but also we got what appeared to be like almost like a hybrid DNA sequence, where we also got evidence of a rare Basque Gaelic type DNA, which just seemed to be totally contradictory. We should have got the same DNA sequence throughout the hair sample, and there is a DNA phenomenon that can occur, particularly in hair samples, called heteroplasmy, which we you can get these kinds of different DNA sequences, but it's usually very small DNA changes. And yet here, this isn't an example of that, because we had such big differences in the DNA sequences. So again, we got sort of evidence that suggested that it almost verifies in a way, or adds sustenance to the idea that this whole thing is all about creating hybrid beings and that kind of thing. And also, if that wasn't enough, we got the suggestion in the nuclear DNA work that we did that there appeared to be possible evidence to support the idea that this hair sample, or the donor of the hair sample, also had a genetic variation that's often referred to as CCR5 deletion factor. Which
what
is
what is that?
Well, that's a factor that it can occur in human DNA, which gives the person who has it the ability to be resistant to things like HIV, AIDS, and smallpox, that kind of thing. So, unfortunately, that genetic factor is fairly rarely distributed amongst the human population. It's not present much in the Asian population or the African population, and probably has its most frequent occurrence in northern European countries, etc. But to have all these kind of unusual DNA results in the one hair sample is, to say the least, particularly from the biochemist point of view who did the work, it's rather mind-boggling.
The chemist who did the work and looked at these DNA results, what kind of a conclusion might he have come to? What did he think? What did he think, maybe not publicly?
Well, there were a number of people that worked on this, and the conclusion from the key people working on it was that they're actually more prone to thinking that it's alien than I am. I'm a little bit more conservative than they are. I would be much more comfortable if we were dealing with literally dozens of samples like this, but because these are fairly rare encounters, we don't have that benefit of that yet. But I'm hoping by putting this extraordinary story out there for people to get into in detail, that we might be able to have perhaps other cases that are perhaps as credible and as well documented as this to back up the evidence that we've found here.
Has Corey taken a polygraph test, Bill?
No. He's offered to do that, but because polygraph evidence is often seen as kind of debatable, and here in Australia, for example, it's not accepted as evidence in court, etc. We haven't really gone
down. Same here, too. They don't really accept it here.
Yeah, unfortunately, these things tend to be fairly problematical. That's why I prefer to look at the DNA aspect of it, because it gives it a sense of possible sort of significance and accuracy that perhaps we might not otherwise have in these sorts of encounters. So I'm still cautious about where this has taken us, but it nevertheless puts a very interesting perspective on the whole alien abduction subject.
Oh, sure. Now, well, explain this to me. If you had the hair of a blonde earthling, a woman, and you looked at the DNA, and then you compared it with this blonde hair from what could be an alien, what would the difference be? What would you see?
Well, you would probably, if it was a blonde, blue-eyed woman, you'd probably get what's called a human consensus DNA result, which is basically probably your Caucasian-type standard DNA range. You wouldn't get the DNA that we got, which sort of stands on the edge of what's referred to as the human consensus. That's a term that's used to define the average range of DNA variation in what's called the hypervariable region. There's a part of the human DNA that varies tremendously that's used by the FBI, for example, to look at human variation and therefore try and track down possible perpetrators of crime. And so it's that area that they focus on, and that's what we focused on as well, to try and see how this hair sample and the DNA from it compared to the average human range of variation in the DNA. And we found that it was right on the edge kind of thing. So it had a lot of unusual attributes to it in terms of the DNA.
So at least with a human with a DNA strand of hair, it would not stand out, would not really be unusual. They'd be able to quickly identify it, right?
Well, we obviously had control samples here. We had samples from Peter. We had samples from his wife and other control samples that we used. And in fact, even when we got this rare Asian mongoloid DNA in the shark, because of its possible Asian nature, we then descended on, we had a biochemist who was of Asian persuasion who worked in the same laboratory environment, who never really touched the sample, but because he was in the same room as the hair sample at points, we actually got him to volunteer his blood as well, and we did his DNA as well just to double check that there wasn't some remote possibility of contamination here. And we found that, as expected, his DNA was quite conventional Asian DNA and not as rare as this Asian mongoloid DNA that we got.
Were they trying to breed with him?
Hmm?
Were they trying to breed with Peter?
Well, that's a speculation that I guess a lot of people have leapt to. Even a lot of the sexual connotations here, people have leapt to the conclusion that he had some sort of sexual encounter, but Peter doesn't see it as a sexual encounter. He doesn't recollect a sexual encounter. There seems to be this element of missing time. We've tried the traditional method of hypnosis, but nothing has come out to try and clarify what happened from that point that he started to have that coughing fit. So we really don't know what played out, but there was a possible earlier experience that I describe in some detail that seems to add some kind of perspective on this experience in 92. We seem to have gotten more recently evidence of an earlier encounter.
So in your particular opinion, you're not so sure who these two beings were, but you got to admit then, with this DNA strand, it was unusual.
Well, I'm kind of forced to that somewhat reluctant conclusion that we seem to have something pretty bizarre here. It could be evidence of an alien nature. I don't know, but the alien sort of, I guess, term is such a fluid term, and people automatically leap towards extraterrestrial, but I just don't know. What it argues for me is that this is a very powerful kind of case study, that this sort of approach should be perhaps utilized in a lot of these sorts of cases, so that the whole kind of CSI kind of forensic scientific approach could be used in similar sorts of cases where maybe biological evidence has been reported. And there have been a number of cases that I mentioned in the book and others that are reported by other researchers, but unfortunately they have been kind of lost opportunities where similar things have occurred, but the sample hasn't been retained, for example.
And Corey's wife believes the story?
Well, she surprised Peter by being really quite supportive of this, you know, and she accepts it as well.
Nice. Stay with us. We'll talk more with our guest, Peter Chalker, and also your phone calls next. Hey, Bill, before we go to calls, tell me about your quest to obtain physical, biological evidence.
Right. Well, obviously, my book here at the Alien gives a very detailed case study of one case. And there's another four cases that we briefly referred to as well that had varying sort of success or evidential value. But obviously, the main focus of the book is really to profile this story and this approach, this perspective, this whole, I guess, forensic take on or DNA paradigm approach to alien abduction stories, and with a view to try and apply science and the forensic approach to possible biological evidence. And because of that, I need to say that obviously we wouldn't be sort of taking a sample or a story at face value, really, because so much hangs on it in terms of the validity of the phenomenon. We would be trying to examine the stories, the experiences in as much detail, trying to establish a chain of evidence that validly connects the sample to the original claim or story, that kind of thing, and the full context of the story. Sure. So it's a fairly involved process, but one that I think is important because it offers the opportunity to put some sort of scientific perspective on it, and therefore we're not necessarily just based on subjective evidence or hypnosis or that kind of thing. We're dealing with possible solid evidence that might provide valid clues to what's really going on.
Now, you said earlier that you weren't as up on this being extraterrestrial as some of the other people. How come?
Well, I just remain open-minded because, yes, it may represent a possible extraterrestrial sample, but the only way you could be certain with that is that if this was these findings were somehow validated by dozens of more similar sorts of samples, because really it's really an extraordinary claim to be able to prove that it's definitely extraterrestrial, because so much hangs on that single statement. And really, in order to prove that to the satisfaction of, I guess, the scientific community and skeptics and all sorts of people out there, you really need to be able to validate that with a large body of evidence. But here we've got one detailed case study to indicate what's possible, what may be involved, and therefore that's why I have that caution.
Okay, let's go to some of the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Welcome, and where are you?
I'm in Altadena, California.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Okay, hi. Well, great show, both of you. Amazing. I have a question regarding your opinions on the validity of scientific remote viewing as a research tool of alien abduction.
Yes, well, I think the remote viewing thing is sort of big on claims and evidence, but really it's really hasn't come up with sort of solid kind of proof that it's an actual working ability. Yes, there's a lot of interesting and compelling kind of information that's going on, a lot of debate, a lot of controversy associated with it. I actually have a fairly long, detailed sort of endnote on the whole remote viewing perspective in my book, but in there as a kind of an endnote or a footnote, because it comes up as a little important sort of side issue in the book.
Excellent. Okay, well, that clearly answers it. Well, thank you. Great show. Very fascinating.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Do you know of any governmental research going on now into the UFOs in Australia, or do they just kind of sweep it away?
Well, we've had a fairly active kind of a research project called the Disclosure Project. It's not related to Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project in the States, but it's an independent project is in conjunction with the Australian UFO Research Network, and it looked at the totality of the government involvement with the UFO subject, and it kind of complemented the work that I did back in 82 to 84. And what it showed is that there's still ongoing kind of flirtation with it, but officially they're saying that they're not interested or involved in the subject. But from the inquiries that I often get with, even from military personnel, there does still seem to be ongoing interest, but not something that's confirmable at an official public level.
Okay, next up, East of the Rockies. Welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, Bob from New Jersey.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing? George, I want to, with your guest make a statement trying to arrive at the true nature of extraterrestrials. But for the probability of probably never getting on your program again, let me just mention one thing before that. And that's your exorcism tape from Britain there?
No, we don't have time for that.
Okay, let me go into the other one then. I just was going to tell you something very interesting you could do with that.
No, but I got a guest, and let's pay him the tribute.
Okay, here we go. Trying to arrive at who ETs really are, religious doctrine really does refer to any order of beings higher than us are indeed angels, whether fallen or not, right? You do have regard for the Marian apparitions. I've heard you talk about them in the past, Fatima, whatnot. In La Salette, France, in that sequence of apparitions, it does make direct passage to certain events that we see. And it goes like there will be astounding prodigies that take place in the air and on the ground. It also makes reference to abductions by saying they will have the power to transport people from one place to another. And that is the message of La Salette, France. Look into that if you get a chance. And as far as your guest is concerned, regarding what I said, what do you think?
Well, I know this. A lot of clues that sort of come to us from what are perceived in traditional sort of religious contexts, etc. But there actually is an important new book that's sort of just been translated into English called Heavenly Lights, The Apparitions of Fatima and the UFO Phenomenon. It's the work of two Portuguese historians and UFO researchers, and it takes the Fatima experiences and looks at it from the benefit of having access to the records of the day, the church records, and it kind of puts an interesting new perspective on what may have occurred there. So I'm open-minded as to what's involved there, but it's an area that one has to pursue with caution because a lot of people have a lot of sensitivities in terms of interpretations of things that might have a religious context.
Bill, are they preserving UFO history? I mean, is there a central funneling point in Australia where this material, these cases, keep going? Is the government continuing to do this, or who is?
Well, certainly the government's not actively doing it, but the Disclosure Project that I mentioned here in Australia is doing that with the official record and to a certain extent with the civilian record, but researchers like myself are heavily involved with this kind of keenness to preserve the historical record, be it of a severe nature or an official nature, and I've interfaced with similar sorts of projects, for example, in America, such as Project 1947 and Project Sign, which is the Sign Historical Group that acts as an arm of the Project 1947. Both of those organisations are devoted to preserving UFO history, and I think this is really kind of important because the longer this phenomenon goes on, the more we should be paying attention to its history as well, because, El Santiano, the philosopher, sort of said, you know, if you don't know your history, you'll be condemned to reliving it. And I know the UFO phenomenon sort of suggests that we've been doing a lot of repeat pedaling on our bicycles as we go through this whole UFO subject. And if we know our history in a lot of detail, we can be better informed in terms of interpreting what's going on today.
West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. And where might you be?
Hi, George and Bill. Keith in Volcano, California.
Hey, Keith. Hi.
Hey, funny you were talking about telescopes on your commercial there. Back when Hale-Bopp was around, back in 97,
yeah,
my son and the neighbor's grandson and I went down to the old historic Observatory Hill, and we had the telescopes out, and we were watching it and everything, and then the moon came up, and we decided to pack in the telescopes, but we had binoculars. And just as we started loading the telescopes, an orange amber orb appeared on the horizon, real low. And I got my telescope aimed right at it, and it came just about maybe 10 degrees off, right towards us, about a 10-degree angle off axis. And it got really close over the field that we were observing across, and it shot true vertical straight up in the sky and disappeared over the Sierra Nevada mountains in less than a second. Absolutely phenomenal.
Wonder what it was.
Well, I know what it was, and I put 20 years in the Navy.
Yep.
Aviation, well-trained, and it wasn't anything in my book.
It was not a plane. Bill.
But what does Bill think about these?
And they're happening everywhere.
Well, it's an international, worldwide phenomenon, and that description you've given there certainly takes that orange light or orange object out of the category of a lot of the orange lights reports that we have here in Australia, and particularly in America, where things like Jiffy fire starters and hot air balloons are used, you know, an object that actually takes off at straight up at high speed and disappears in a second. It's very difficult to explain away as something prosaic or a hoax or anything like that. It seems like it's all bona fide to the UFO description.
Okay, thanks for being on the program. Next up, east of the Rockies, your turn. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
My name is James. I'm calling from New York, and I would like to ask your guest if he ever heard of the research of Dr. Thomas Townsend Brown in the field of anti-gravity research. That's where I feel most of this UFO stories come from. I mean, I'm very familiar I've become familiar with what he's done and what his accomplishments are, and I wonder if you or your guest can make any comment about this gentleman.
Now, what do you mean, though, that most of these UFO reports come from anti-gravity stories?
Well, Dr. Brown himself was an individual who was interested in UFOs, and what he discovered was, when he was a young man, that certain types of materials, I think one of them was Bakelite, if you charged it with electricity, and you could get up to something like 300,000 volts, it would show a movement towards its positive pole.
Do you ever investigate the type of propulsion systems that are out there, Bill?
Well, it's something that we obviously look at as researchers. The kind of clues that you have in UFO reports, particularly the bona fide ones, obviously, might give clues as to what kind of propulsion systems are going on. Townsend Brown's work is often used by people to argue that a lot of the UFO phenomena due to man-made kind of objects that are suppressed, etc., that kind of thing. But as the listener mentioned there, he seemed, inspired to a certain extent by the UFO phenomenon that he was aware of. And as far as I'm aware, I believe Townsend Brown was one of the early members of NICAP, one of the early UFO groups in America back in the 1950s. So, maybe it is a way of understanding UFO propulsion, but it's such a complex phenomenon that it's very, very difficult to put a handle on it. But maybe it represents advanced technology, and by paying attention to UFO reports, we can get a better handle on it.
13 years since the Peter Corey case. He's now about 41, 42 years old. What is he doing? Do you keep in touch with him?
I'm in quite regular contact with Peter, and I think it's courageous of Peter to be involved with helping put this story out. He's steadfastly stood by the story and has run the gauntlet, so to speak, from, my interrogations or interviews, and it's been fairly intense, the research, etc., and he's put up with my intrusions, and the story, his experience and his credibility and the evidence, as far as I'm concerned, has stood up to that scrutiny and survived the gauntlet. And so we have Peter's story, as far as Hera the Alien's concerned, out there for people to examine and consider.
And apparently the 1992 case was not his first case, was it?
No, he had an earlier experience, as I mentioned briefly earlier, in 1988, that seemed to take the classic form, I guess, of what people recognise as the typical grey alien encounter. But for him at that time, he had no real awareness of the UFO subject and no context to put this in. And having just sort of come from his native country was Lebanon, coming across as a child and then sort of growing up in the Australian community, when he first had this experience, he had no real reference point to understand it, and it was only months later that he was driving around with his future wife that he and his fiancée observed large poster displays of Whitney Strieber's paperback edition of Communion, and it stunned him when he saw that poster of the alien face, because that's what he had encountered back in 1988, and yet the initial posters that he observed with his partner didn't give any clue as to what was it about. It was part of a sophisticated kind of advertising campaign to introduce the paperback edition of Whitney Strieber's book, and it took another week or two before they learnt that this was all about a book. And when finally his partner acquired the book, she kept telling him, "You've got to read this. You know, it's full of stuff that you're telling me. You've been telling me about that happened to you." And eventually, he did sort of look at the book, and he found plenty of similarities, but just as many dissimilarities as well. So for him, it was kind of a preliminary anchor point as to what might be going on.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Pat from Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Pat, welcome. Hi.
Thank you. And I had a question on how you can tell the difference between our stealth things and UFOs. I saw something, it's been a couple of years ago, but it was one of the triangular things.
Yes.
And I saw it, like, real close. I mean, if you hold your arms up, it was, like, covered, you know, as far as you could go and spread them out 3 feet. That's how big the thing was in the sky. But it was like an equilateral triangle, but all the corners were rounded. And on the bottom of it, it looked kind of like a bath mat. I mean, you know how you're looking at it, because it was evenly spaced and it had all these round things on it, but it didn't have a single light on it, and it didn't make any noise.
Well, one of the things we wonder about here, Bill, in this country, is whether people are seeing real UFOs or if they're seeing American technology. Or, in some cases, I'm wondering if you're looking at reversed engineered technology, where we've picked up ideas from saucers and craft and made these planes.
Well, I guess that all those possibilities could be what's going on, but when you have those objects or similar objects sort of landing, and out steps unusual creatures, etc., that don't appear to be human, or they're doing things that seem to go way beyond our abilities as, I guess, flesh and blood humans, etc., that kind of thing, really bizarre interactions and that kind of thing, that's when you start to appreciate more readily that we're dealing with a UFO phenomenon, something that seems to be totally alien to us. But when they're up in the sky, etc., and particularly in more recent years, the pace of advanced technology and defence developments, etc., it does make it more and more difficult to, I guess, reconcile what are we dealing with, particularly when in the area of triangular objects.
We'll be back with final phone calls in a moment. And welcome back to Coast with our guest Bill Chucker, final segment. Bill, with the reports that you continue to investigate, do they still seem to be coming in at the same pace, or are they slowing down?
Well, I've always felt that there's a high sort of smoke-to-signal kind of ratio, noise-to-signal ratio kind of going on, that there's always been a consistent core UFO phenomenon that's really difficult to explain, and seems to be the bona fide UFO phenomenon when you get through it and investigate it thoroughly. That seems to be still consistent. What changes is that you get a lot of misidentified type of events, etc., and they're generally easy to fathom out. You know, obviously genuine misidentifications of aircraft and astronomical objects, that kind of thing, those sort of things have a continual ebb and flow, and quite often that can correlate with media publicity or the latest sci-fi film coming out, that kind of thing. But the UFO phenomenon seems to be generally fairly consistent at a kind of a lower level.
You know, you talked about that one case where a UFO seemed to come out of a pond, and you talked about the reeds. Do you get many reports of underwater UFO sightings, and then people see it splash out of the ocean and just take off?
Well, yes, we do get the odd occasional reports of those. They're somewhat rarer, but they're certainly interesting kinds of cases. And even the submarine type object that you often get, or unidentified submerged object, whatever, that seems to be capable of things that are beyond anything that we have going around underwater.
All right, let's go back to the phones. First-time caller line, welcome to the program. You're on the air with us. Hi.
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm really appreciate that I can get through. I tried numerous times, but you remember recently you were talking about synchronicity and,
yes.
and the odds of things falling into place.
Mm-hmm.
I've had three, I almost fell off my chair, I've had three come up just on the last three calls, which all correlate to what your guest from Down Under is talking about.
Okay, go ahead.
And this is absolutely amazing. But one night, I don't know if it was Art or yourself on the air, some fellows called in that had seen one of these black triangular things, much the same as what your lady, your former caller, was talking
mm-hmm.
about, no sound, the rounded corners, huge, enormous. Came right over their fishing boat with no sound, like a great horned owl, you know, just silent. And that night they had called in. I was walking my hound dog in a wooded area next to a military base, and I saw some creatures that I hope never to see again.
What did they look like?
I'm afraid to even describe them. They were like half humanoid, half robotic. I could see two of them. Actually, my dog spotted them when he ran down a road. Have you ever seen a hound dog backtrack slowly?
I remember one of my labs did that a long time.
Yeah, well,
he
knew something was there that could eat him up. Anyway, these things, I know what I saw. I heard them. They were communicating with each other inside the military base with a liquid sound, like the old, you know, the Meborp and all this stuff. It was like it was coming through liquid with a little light luminescence. I thought, I ain't sticking around for this. But what was strange is when we hiked up the hill, this is right across the bay from where these fishermen had called in and saw it go, the black object go over. A small dog was barking at them further up, and it barked, and then it ceased to bark forever. In fact, that whole neighborhood, I haven't seen any sign of life all along that fence line since that night.
I wonder if you've shared that story with some of the local UFO research groups like MUFON or QFOS.
Well, I did call in because they have these terror watch things. I did call into the military base to alert them that there was, you know, they say to be vigilant, and they kind of acted like maybe I shouldn't be talking about it.
Like, what about communicating with a civilian group, perhaps one of the civilian research
groups? Yeah, I'd like to. Anyway, what's strange is that that night, further up the coast, where these other fishermen, we had a 43-foot fishing boat totally disappeared. No trace of it's ever been found, and its crew.
What was the weather like then?
Pretty calm.
Mm.
And we've had several, over the last few years in Central California, we've had several fishing vessels totally disappear. And what's strange is they have the satellite communication thing for locating. And in each case, they've only had one blip on the thing and then nothing, which is almost impossible. These things are supposed to send off even in a deep-sea canyon like we have here in the bay. And in each case, there's one blip and then one life jacket, no trace of the boat or the crew.
You know, Bill, these could be frightening cases where you have these abductions occurring. You know, it's bad enough to be tested on and then they leave you and then they go. But to be taken from this planet, like the case you were talking about of the pilot and huge ships being taken and things like that, it makes you wonder what they're doing with this.
Well, it certainly conjures up all sorts of sort of strange, bizarre possibilities, and some, obviously, as you say, are frightening possibilities as well. But I guess really what we need to do here is to be as armed with as much sort of verified information as we can to really understand what's truly going on, because there's a big difference between a sort of anecdotal story, but if you're dealing with something that's been documented in a lot of detail, etc., then we get the kind of true measure of what's going on. And when we have collectively a lot of those sorts of well-documented experiences, we can approach this with much greater certainty. It's really about being better informed and to get an understanding of what's truly going on.
David Jacobs writes that these visitations aren't as benevolent as most people would think.
Well, a lot of people have conflicting viewpoints about it, and I'm open-minded to this. You know, I've sort of had cross-sections of that whole kind of broad spectrum of perceptions about the nature of it, whether it's positive or whether it's negative or hostile, friendly, that kind of thing. And so I'm kind of open-minded, and really it comes back to, I guess, trying to scrutinize these cases as carefully as we can and to get a better understanding of what the reality is all about.
Pick up by going east of the Rockies. Welcome to the program. Where are you calling from?
Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, it's all yours.
All right, two questions for you. One, you're from Australia. Are you an AC/DC fan?
Of course. We all are here.
Right on, right on. Good to hear. All right, my question is, back in the early 1990s, there was footage taken from a space shuttle. To be a UFO being shot at, and the shot came from near Australia, near Ayers Rock. You ever heard about any kind of secret installation or whatnot over there in the desert near Ayers Rock?
Well, of course, that case of the shuttle footage, et cetera, it's pretty controversial. And yes, people have suggested that there seems to be evidence on the footage that there was some sort of light beam or firing, et cetera, that came from the centre of Australia, et cetera. And I guess the only facility we have there of any consequence is the Pine Gap facility, and it has all sorts of apocryphal stories connected to it. And in terms of what we've been able to verify, it's really obviously a sensitive American base that is shared with the Australians, etc. But it remains to be seen as to what's truly going on there.
You don't really have any idea what they might be doing there?
Well, what I'm saying or what I'm trying to say here is that there are a lot of claims made, but those sort of more striking stories of suggestions of underground bases there and an alien connection or whatever, these are virtually impossible to verify. They're just really extraordinary stories, et cetera, but usually not. We're not able to verify them, but it's certainly a source of a lot of rumours, a lot of claims, and a lot of extraordinary tales, that kind of thing. So we just try to investigate them. We have researchers there that are affiliated with the Australian UFO Research Network based in that kind of area that sort of try to document cases in that area, and it does seem to be a bit of a hotspot for UFO reports.
Okay, great. Thanks for your phone call. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're up with us. Hi there.
Hi, Bill. Hi, George. It's Jim in Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Jim. Hey,
Bill, how do you spell your last name?
Chalker, C-H-A-L-K-E-R.
Okay. I can remember that. I was wondering in your investigations if it's, you know, people who believe in UFOs are more likely to see them than someone who doesn't. I mean, it's almost a necessity to – you got to believe it before you see it. And then also
I don't really agree with that statement, because there's plenty of skeptically inclined people that have had UFO encounters as well. And so that's kind of a bit of a folklore to UFO sightings, that it's entirely represented by true believers, et cetera.
Well, I didn't mean it that way, but I wanted to get your take on it. Almost the paranormal stuff, you know, I mean, like out of Star Wars, you got to believe it before you can do it or something or see it. And then I was wondering if people of, if certain ethnicity, sorry, like Irish and Native Americans, are more likely to see it than to have an encounter or something like that than not. You know, I mean,
well, I think if anything comes out of this evening's program, it's the fact that this is a worldwide UFO phenomenon. Therefore, there are people from all sorts of different ethnic backgrounds that have had these encounters: China, Africa, South America, Australia, United States, all through Europe. Sightings come from everywhere, and all sorts of people report them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was wondering if, you know, are they more likely to occur in stressful situations, you know, where somebody's in danger or something like that, and then, you know, maybe he or a relative will see one of those things? Right? From family experience here.
Right. Like a crisis apparition type thing, you mean, or some sort of connection between family members observing something?
Well, I'll put it, 30 years ago, my aunt was lost snowmobiling in southwest Montana. It was 25, 30 below zero Fahrenheit, and they came across a prospector's old cabin, a ramshackle thing, not much left of it. She and her friend built a fire, stayed warm, you know, as they could, you know, they got through the night. They survived. And my uncle, on the way out, you know, somebody saw the fire, and, you know, and the rescue was made on the way out. He saw one, you know, and he's a believable guy. Personally, I don't want to believe in him, and I've got a little cognitive dissonance. I mean, I'd rather believe they don't exist, but, hey, my uncle saw one, and he's a pretty credible guy. And
right.
And
people have seen them under the least likely circumstances, stressful circumstances, and obviously under circumstances where people haven't been stressed, etc. It happens at all sorts of different times.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, appreciate your work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Reptilians, have you ever come across any of your research?
Well, that's pretty much a very bizarre kind of take. But believe it or not, I've got a couple of little detail footnotes in the book about that as well, but it's sort of a pretty difficult area to sort of cover in sort of brief detail.
But you do believe they're visiting us?
Well, I certainly accept that people are reporting these sorts of stories, but it's kind of a almost like an atavistic take on, I guess, our kind of connections with the past and the animal world and that kind of stuff. But it's certainly something that pops up in a lot of these shaman-type accounts and in some of these shaman cases. I treat one in detail in my book, The Experiences of Credo Matwa, Zulu shaman in Africa, who has sort of those kinds of takes on the UFO phenomenon.
Next up, Wild Card Line, your turn. Where are you?
Hi, I'm Mark, Winnipeg, Canada.
Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Great show, George. I got a quick question for you, kind of touching on what the last caller asked. I was wondering, of all the cases that you have investigated that have seemed a little bit more credible, where people have had close encounters with extraterrestrials, have you noticed any, obviously there's different ethnicity differences and stuff, but have you noticed any similarities? Is there anything that these extraterrestrials are looking for? Is there a rhyme or reason? Because I know many people that haven't seen them. I mean, George, you admitted to yourself that you haven't had an encounter.
No,
so
that's right.
These people that have really good experiences that you've investigated, like, what are they looking for? Is there like a rhyme or reason why they pick some people? Or?
There's sort of suggestive things, but really when it comes down to hard documented sort of correlations, there aren't really correlations that you could hang your hat on, because if we knew those correlations, we'd be sort of monitoring those situations very, very carefully, and that would allow us to kind of predict the occurrences of these things, but yet we don't have that kind of certainty.
Okay, thanks for your call. A few more minutes left. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, where are you calling from?
Hi, George. This is Sue. I'm calling from Indiana.
Hi, Sue. Go ahead. We've got a couple minutes left.
Okay. I just wondered from your guest if he's ever heard of any alien-type entities communicating with each other, kind of like the one of the last callers talked about, in some kind of language that sounds similar to water or dribbling water.
There are accounts that we've had in Australia like that, but there is a great variety of things that are reported. Yes, we have had sort of situations like that, but we've had other sorts of cases as well.
That gives me the creeps, because I've heard something like that, and I thought for sure that it was entities speaking. But whatever these entities were completely invisible to the human eye at the time. And it bothers me very much that this came up, because I thought I was, like, maybe crazy, I don't know. This is the first time that I've ever heard any ufologists of any kind or alien-type people that are talking about this stuff bring up that subject of what their languages might sound like. And,
well, I think it really boils down to people like yourself and others that have had these sort of experiences, that they should sort of get in contact with groups like civilian groups that are well represented in America and around the world. And if we know about these things, we can better understand what is going on. And obviously, that's the kind of information that we need.
This is very unusual. This happened in New Hampshire on my sister's property. And it was late at night and stuff, and I thought maybe the neighbors left water running, but apparently not. It's quite frightening, but thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You.
She sounds upset, and it does affect people sometimes that way, I guess, huh?
Well, that's clearly the case. Sometimes these experiences are a major confrontation, like, for example, with Peter Curie's experience in my book, Hair of the Alien. The first chapter is called Shattered World. You know, his first major experience back in 88 was really shattering his kind of worldview. It was really a real major confrontation and really sort of turned his whole world perception upside down.
Fascinating
picture. Quite a major impact on him.
There is a graphic picture of him on a table from that 1988 encounter, and he doesn't look too happy. They're sticking some kind of needle in his head.
Yes, yes. That was a pretty shattering experience for him and really extraordinarily frightening for him.
And then, of course, is the picture of the blonde woman and the Asian who were in his room in 1992. Fascinating.
That obviously had a different impact on him, and at least it provided some sort of impressive evidence for us to look at to really try and get a handle on what's going on here.
Absolutely. Bill, thanks for spending the time with us. If I ever get to Australia, I'll look you up.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Nikki Imbrononi, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.